Okay. Good morning, everyone. The Senate Education Committee will come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 18, 2015. It's 8:30 a.m. We're in room 112 at the State Capitol. Today we have a few items before us, primarily the Education Policy Bill. We'll be doing a walkthrough of that and also get testimony. It's our intent to meet tomorrow morning to entertain any potential amendments and then hopefully adopt the policy bill. We have three other bills before us that just need to be processed. We do not have a quorum at this point, and so we'll act on those items following the ed policy walkthrough. So first we'll go to the education policy bill draft. It has been posted online. And what I'd like to do is have staff go through the various articles, and after each article, we'll see if members have any questions. And following the presentation of the articles, we'll open it up for testimony. We have at least four people that have indicated they'd like to testify regarding the draft policy bill, and if there's anyone else here that has not indicated their intent, please let us know and we will do our very best to accommodate that. So we'll proceed to the draft policy bill. That is Senate File 1495. And we'll have Mr. Artisan and Ms. Butler, who have been working throughout the weekend, as well as staff, and Jay, the whole team has been putting this together, and we appreciate that. And we'll go first to Article 1, Bjorn Arneson.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll begin with Article 1, and I'm making reference now to the document marked SCS 1495A-2. Article 1 consists entirely of sections from the agency's technical bill. Section 1 strikes an obsolete pupil unit reference. Section 2 modifies the date by which the commissioner must set the student achievement rate. Section 3 strikes a bunch of obsolete language and making a technical change, inserts a reference to operating capital aid in the definition of general education revenue. Section 4 inserts new language, technical language, to conform with the changes made last biennium with regard to board-approved referendum allowances. Section 5 strikes language at the bottom of page 3 and at the top of page 4, clarifying the calculation of referendum allowances with the local optional revenue subtraction. Section 6 clarifies that any levy reductions following on taconite payments would exclude the student achievement levy from those reductions. And Section 7, the repealer on page 5, repeals a retired employee health insurance levy for which no district qualifies any longer. That concludes Article 1.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions from members on Article 1? Again, we'll make an opportunity available for the public on these articles following the presentation and any questions that need to be addressed by the committee. Okay, let's proceed to Article 2. Ms. Butler.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 2 starts on page 5 at the bottom, and Section 1 is from Senate File 337, which was a Senator Pappas bill relating to directory information. Then on page 6, Section 2 is from one of the first sections for the Senator Coonan bill, Senate File 162, that related to the flexible learning year program. Section 3 is from Senate File 434, which is the Senator Chamberlain bill that relates to the review and revision of the mathematics academic standards. Then Section 4 is the first section in Article 2 that's from the agency bill, and this one, as well as Section 5, relate to the state bilingual and multilingual seals. And that then goes on to page 10, And page 10, section 6, is also from the agency bill, or actually it's from a couple of bills. Then the lines 10.6 to 10.13 are from the agency bill related to the ag science or career tech ed credits, fulfilling science credits. Then if you look at 10.22 to 10.23, that was Senate File 1248 from Senator Stumpf related to computer science credits. And then 1024 to 1026 was an amendment to that bill from Senator Claussen related to Project Lead the Way credits. Section 7 at the bottom of page 10 is from Senate File 1067, which was a Senator Wieger bill on grade promotion and retention. Section 8 on page 11 was also from Senate File 278, which is Senator Chamberlain bill of local literacy plans. And then on page 12, section 9 is from the agency bill, and that just is striking a reference to a statute that is contained in the repealer. And then page 13, section 10, is the beginning of the agency's modifications to the statewide assessment system. And that actually goes on for several pages and several sections that gets you then to page 20. And that's section 11, which is also still part of the agency bill. And it's just some technical corrections that they're making to the assessment system and reporting. Then section 12 on page 22 is also from the agency bill related to developing a list about special circumstances where a student may be unable to test. And then section 13 is also from the agency bill with reporting. Section 14 is agency bill about administration and usage of the statewide assessments. on the bottom page 23, section 15 is also from the agency bill of the access test, updating that language. Section 16 on page 24 is also agency language, updating that section about testing and making local assessments consistent with the requirement for the statewide assessments. Section 17 is from one of the first sections from Senate File 559, which is Senator Claussen's bill related to teacher licensure. And that goes on for a few pages until we get to section 18 on page 27, which is another Senator Claussen Senate File 1220. That relate to retired principals and continuing education requirements. Section 19, then on page 28, takes it back to Senate File 559 and the teacher licensure requirements. And section 20 on page 29 is also from the same Senate file related to teacher licensures. Then section 21 on page 30 is Senate File 475. It's the Senator Rosen file. Senate file on grounds for revoking or a teacher license with certain convictions. Then section 22 on page 31 is from Senate File 559, and that relates to licensure via portfolio. Section 23, which most language is on page 32 or written there on, is from Senate File 559, and that's related to teachers that are trained in other states. And then section 24 on page 34 is from Senate File 559, and that relates to teacher preparation programs, alternative teacher preparation programs. And that goes the same for section 25. And then section 26 is from Senate File 1554, which is Senator Kent's Senate File, but related to classroom placement. You can see it, the new language is over on page 37. The same goes for section 27, which is from the same Senate file. That just is the same language for school districts located in the city of the first class. Then on page 40 is section 28, which is from Senate File 1185, is from Senator Peterson, and that relates to the placement of student teachers with licensed teachers. Section 29 is from Senate File 106, which is Senator Bonoff, related to college in the schools and world language courses. Section 30 on page 41 is from the agency bill. And then section 31 is also from the agency bill. Then section 32 is, again, from the agency bill, and it's the beginning of some of the charter school sections from that bill, and that also goes on for a number of pages. So section 33, again, charter schools on page 45. Then section 34, agency on page 49. Then 35 starts on page 51. And then if you get to page 52, section 36 is a charter school provision, though, from Senator Johnson, Senate file 164, related to pupil performance. Then page 54, section 37, is also from the agency bill, as well as section 38 with annual public reports. Section 39 is also from the agency bill, and it relates to charter school mergers. Then in the middle of page 55, section 40, 41, and 42 on to 43 are from Senate file 162, which is the Senator Coonan bill related to the flexible learning year program. Section 44 is from the agency bill. And then section 45, down at the bottom of page 56, is one of many sections from the agency bill that relate to American Indian education. And that actually takes you to page, I think it's like 63. Yes, so through section 60, which ends in the middle of page 63, are all the agency provisions with American Indian education. Then section 61 on page 63 is another section from Senate file 278, which is the Senator Chamberlain bill, as well as section 62, which is the definition of dyslexia from that same Senate file, as well as section 63. Section 64 on page 65 is from the agency bill related to teacher development evaluation revenue. Then on page 66, section 65 is an amendment that was to Senate file 115 with Senator Wieger, but there was also a bunch of individual bills for various school districts related to the school start date for this upcoming school year. So this allows for the school year to begin on September 1, but only for the 2015-2016 school year. Then section 66 is related to the bilingual and multilingual seals. Then page 66 down the bottom, section 67 is repealer. Paragraph A is from the agency bill. And then paragraph B is from the Senate file 162, the Senator Coonan bill related to flexible learning year programs.
Thank you, Ms. Butler. Quorum's present. Questions on Article 2? Article 3.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 3 begins on page 67. It's headed Special Programs. Section 1 originates from Senator Hoffman bill, Senate file 1001. And there are a number of sections relating to that bill. Section 1 would require a district to adopt a discipline policy for elementary students that outlines alternatives to suspension. Section 2 would direct a school district to develop programming to address underlying causes of disruptive behavior. Section 3 directs the superintendent to annually report to the school board on suspensions. Section 4, the new language, begins on page 68, includes written agreements by parents to withdraw a child from school as an alternative to expulsion in that report. Section 5, alternatives to pupil suspension, lists a number of alternatives, including alternative restorative consequences, in-school suspensions, and others. Section 6, the new language is near the bottom of page 69, amends the removal of from class policy components to include the use of mobile crisis response teams. Section 7 would require a school administrator to make a reasonable effort to immediately contact the parent when a child is removed from a school or school grounds by a peace officer. Section 8 originates from the agency bill. It removes the references to the Minnesota Resource Center serving deaf and hard of hearing as these duties are now carried out by the Department of Ed through the K through 12 deaf and hard of hearing coordinator. And there are a number of sections that make a similar change here. So section 9, similar. Section 10 on page 72 clarifies that the responsibility for transportation to and from program sites includes services included in a child's IEP. Section 11 makes a technical change to the Interagency Early Interventions Committee statute to conform with some changes from last biennium. The same with Section 12. Section 13 makes technical changes to the Interagency Early Interventions Committee statute and also reorganizes that statute for better readability. It looks like a lot of new language, but in fact it's just kind of moving some language around. The next section begins on page 78. Section 14 clarifies that the IEP team must consider positive behavioral interventions, strategies, and supports that address behavior needs for all children, and requires the school board to ensure that paraprofessionals providing direct support to students have specific training. And this comes from a Senator Hoffman bill, 1002. The next section begins on page 80, section 15. This originates from a Senator Pratt bill. It would require that a district contract with online case management reporting, or with a reporting system that is compatible with the statewide online case management reporting system. And then the section 16 following is related to that and comes from the same bill. And it section 16 would remove the requirement that a district transition to the statewide system by the 2018-19 school year. The next section is on page 82, section 17. There are a number of sections here now that modify the language to make reference to Part C wherever there are references to Part B or to an IEP. So this is true for section 17, and these are all from the agency bill. Section 18 requires the or allows the State Interagency Coordinating Council 30 days to recommend policies after receiving the Part C annual performance report. Section 19 makes technical changes again to reflect the duties of the Resource Center for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing are now carried out by the coordinator at the department. Section 20 makes a similar technical change. Section 21, similar technical change. Section 22, similar technical change. Section 23, that begins on page 88, the new language begins on the bottom of page 89, and it clarifies that special ed aid is paid directly to cooperatives, ed districts, and intermediate districts beginning in fiscal 16. This is conforming language from the 2013 omnibus bill. Section 24, a similar conforming change related to the payment of special education aids. And section 25, the repealer on page 91, removes the reporting requirement for districts receiving, section 25 on page 91, repeals the subdivision related to the transfer of the resource centers for the deaf or hard of hearing and blind or visually impaired to the Department of Education. With the earlier technical changes, this subdivision is obsolete and is repealed in this bill. And that concludes Article 3.
Thank you. Questions on Article 3? Article 4.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 4 consists of one section originating from the agency bill. It would remove the requirement that a district have a current technology plan on file with the department in order to generate telecom access aid.
Questions on Article 4? Article 5.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 5 starts on page 91. It's entirely from the agency bill and relates to the early learning scholarships. So section 1 relates to the eligibility for the scholarships in that the students who are receiving the federally funded Race to the Top scholarships then would receive a state-funded scholarship in an equal amount as long as funds are available. Section 2 lists or adds to the prioritization list for recipients of the scholarship to include child in foster care or experiencing homelessness, or the child of a parent under 21 who's pursuing a high school general education diploma, equivalency diploma, or post-secondary education or training. Section 3 relates to providers and their eligibility to participate in the scholarship program and disqualifies certain providers from participating if they've engaged in certain behaviors or have been found or to done some things that people didn't really like. Then Section 4 would be the record-keeping requirements for program participants and having those records available upon request of the commissioner. Then Section 5 is the use of the scholarship funds, and that requirement that the child that's receiving the scholarship attend the program on a regular basis, respective to that program's schedule. And that is the end of Article 5.
Thank you. Questions on Article 5? Article 6.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 6 is the state agency's article, and that is also in its entirety from the agency's bill. Section 1 is a reporting requirement for districts related to the third grade reading report, and including that into the World's Best Workforce reporting requirements. Section 2 is the alternative teacher professional pay system reporting, including that in the World's Best Workforce reporting requirements. Section 3 is the staff development report, including that in the World's Best Workforce. And then on page 96, on line 96.14 is a consolidated commission report, and putting the that's on February 1st of each year, that puts the commissioner's portion of the staff development report included in that February 1st report. Section 4 relates to a dispute between a district and a cooperative unit, and if the Office of Administrative Hearings is included, that the cost for that equally split between the district and the cooperative unit. Section 5 is related to submitting financial data and the timeline, or certain financial data and the timeline for those submissions. Section 6 is including the special education litigation cost report into the one February 1st report from the commissioner. Then Section 7 is the report from the commissioner on the teacher workforce. Then Section 8 is where the list of the reports that would be due February 1st from the commissioner are consolidated into one, and you can see the 8 reports listed there. Section 9 moves a deadline for a finalization of 8 payments for the previous fiscal year from December 30th to December 15th. Section 10 makes the Commissioner of Education the compact commissioner for the interstate compact on the educational opportunities of military children. That was put as the P20 Education Partnership Chair. And that's the end of Article 6.
Thank you. Questions on Article 6? Article 7.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 7 is actually the contents of one bill, which was Senate File 1189, that Senator Rieger brought forward that recodifies the charter school statutes. It makes some technical changes, but then back towards page 112, or starting actually in 111, you can see the list and moving the one section into its own article, 124E.
Thank you. Questions on Article 7 or of any of the preceding articles? And for viewers perhaps wondering, you know, why don't we have questions? These have been heard, these proposals in committee in the past. It reflects a great deal of discussion, of consensus building to bring parties together, and this reflects in many ways a bipartisan agreement on many key subjects in testing, on licensure issues, et cetera. So appreciate all the work that's gone into it thus far. As I mentioned, we're going to open it up for testimony from the public to share any observations they'd like. And then tomorrow when we meet, we'll entertain any potential amendments and then take action on the bill, hopefully by tomorrow, Friday, if necessary. So, members, if there's no comments or further at this time, we'll open it up to the public. And I have four people that have indicated an expression of wanting to testify. Melissa Sweetmilk and Jenna King, also Jim Bartholomew and Heidi Hustler. So maybe we'll start with Ms. Sweetmilk and Ms. King. And well, for each of the testifiers, we ask for our record that you identify yourself. And if you're representing someone other than yourself, please indicate that as well. And welcome to the committee.
Sorry, the interpreters are just trying to get set up. I missed the last thing that you said. Could you say that one more time, please?
Welcome.
The part about what you want them to do. Say their names.
If they're representing someone in addition to themselves.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Sweetmilk. I am the interim director of Metro Deaf School. Members of the committee and Mr. Chair, I am Jenna King, and I am a parent here. We want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today and to share our concerns with an issue that has arisen regarding our preschool. Metro Deaf School is a charter school in St. Paul, Minnesota, that serves deaf and hard of hearing students, mostly from the metro area. I'm here to discuss an issue that has had an impact on our preschool children and their families. We're hoping that the amendment that we propose will have be able to address this issue. Mm-hmm. With me, I have Jenna King. We serve pre-K through 12 students in the Twin Cities metro area. We are 100% special ed, which makes us a very unique program. Students are generally enrolled at MDS through district placement or through parent enrollment, through parent choice. Since 1996, MDS has had a pre-K program and has enrolled our pre-K ECSE students through the same two options. This has not been an issue until it was brought to our attention through a memo from MDE that this applies only to
the
district,
parent
that parent choice
only applies to K
through only applies to K-12. Now going forward, all of our students, our pre-K students, must be district placed. Our students from last year, 2013-2014, have been grandfathered in through MDE. This new issue has created a problem with our preschool, and it provides barriers for families that want to enroll their students at MDS, whose districts will not allow for them to be placed, even if they already have older siblings that are staying at MDS, that are at MDS enrolled. This goes against the spirit of the parent choice law, in which parents can choose the school or program that they feel best meets their child's needs. This becomes more important when special education and particularly deaf education is involved and becomes a factor. There are several layers to this issue. MDS is a charter school. It provides special education and is a public school. We have a myriad of laws that apply to us, and sometimes it is difficult to discern or interpret the overlap of several statutes, whether it's charter school law, special education law, general education law, early childhood. The list goes on. Adding to this mix are the new statutes allowing charter schools to provide pre-K programs, which has understandably been a confusing process for MDS. As we already have already had a pre-K ECSE program in place for many years, and also provide ECSE, which is a mandated service. The MDE, Minnesota Department of Education, has been providing us with assistance in sorting through these layers and statutes, as well as taking into consideration our unique status as a school with the services that we provide. I'd like to thank Commissioner Caecilius and the Minnesota Department of Education for their help and time with this issue. Like I mentioned before, there has been an amendment proposed that will address this issue, and I hope you will take this into consideration and support this amendment that allow deaf and hard of hearing children to have access to services and programs that fit their needs earlier, allowing for language acquisition and learning instead of delaying this until they are in kindergarten and 5 years old. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Sweetmill.
And my name is Jenna King, and I'm here to talk about the parent and district placement law. I want to tell you a story about this, because right now parents do not have the choice to place their children in a special ed preschool, pre-kindergarten program. And to illustrate this, I want to tell you a story about my experience. Our oldest daughter, Delaney, was born in Florida. And a few days after she was born, we found out that she was deaf. And at first, our first concern was, what are we going to do about her education? Where is she going to get the best education? My husband, who is also here, we are both products of the deaf education system, and so we know what was necessary to help our daughter succeed. We lived in the Tampa Bay area, and their deaf program, we weren't sure would meet our needs. My husband is a proud fourth-generation deaf person from Lakeville, Minnesota. And we started doing research, and we found Metro Deaf School, and we were very impressed with their program. They had proven results with their students. We even traveled to the school, and we were very impressed with what they had to offer and wanted our daughter to go to school there. And we found out that there was also a parent placement option, so we thought, great. And we sold our house in Florida. My husband negotiated with his company to make sure he would be able to work remotely from home. So we packed up everything, and we moved to Minnesota, and we looked for a house. We signed a contract for a house. And then I remember we were so excited that day. We contacted the Metro Deaf School and said, we're ready to enroll our daughter in your school. And they said, I'm sorry, we can't accept your daughter. And we were shocked. We found out that the Minnesota Department of Education had just eliminated parental choice and required only district placement option for students, and so for pre-K. So then we had to check out the St. Paul Public School program. So my husband and I tried to keep an open mind, and we toured the St. Paul program, the Four Seasons Elementary School program, and we looked around and we really weren't happy with what we saw there. We didn't feel like that was what was going to meet our daughter's needs. So we canceled the contract for the house and decided to rent a house instead, and we got into negotiations, and luckily Metro Deaf School was willing to help us negotiate and work with the Minnesota Department of Education. And after a while, they figured out a way to grandfather our daughter into their school. Well, recently our second daughter was born, and we found out that she too is deaf. And we thought, oh boy, here we go again. Like my husband likes to say, being deaf is a full-time job in and of itself. So immediately, our daughter Elise was placed in the Birth to Three program here in St. Paul. And we were very direct from the beginning that we wanted her to be placed at Metro Deaf School, where her sister was going to school. That's the only thing that made sense to us. But the people who were working the program right away were saying, nope, I'm sorry, it's the law. She will not be able to go to that school for preschool. I'm sorry. And we wanted to have an option based on her needs, not on this arbitrary rule, this law. And we also don't want our girls to be separated into two different programs. So we've been here for 2 years in Minnesota, and those two years have been very stressful. My husband has been looking for a job someplace else, and he found a job in Austin, Texas. And we're really disappointed in many ways because we wanted to stay here. But as parents have to look at the needs for our daughters and find a program that is the best thing that will fit their needs. I so much wanted to stay here in Minnesota. I love it here. But I can't gamble with my second daughter's education. Because from age 0 to 5, that is the most critical time for language development. So it's very important that from 0 to 5 that a student is in the right program. I can't have my youngest daughter in a subpar program when there's a strong deaf school in her own backyard that could be an option, but she can't go to it because of the poorly worded law. And I don't want her to be separated from her older sister. So I hope that you will please consider that age birth to 5 is the most important time for children to be able to have the best access to the strongest educational foundation to find the places that they can thrive. That's the most important time frame. And I don't want other families to have to go through what we did. So please consider creating an amendment that clarifies that special ed preschool, pre-kindergarten, that it can be a parent-placed program where parents can be the ones who decide what best fits the needs of their children. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. King, Ms. Sweetmilk, for sharing your testimony. Reference was made to an amendment. We have not received an amendment, but I'm going to ask the Department of Education to please respond. I believe you indicated there's been dialogue with them, and if they could please share their comments and suggestions on moving ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Adosh Uni with the Minnesota Department of Education. Members from the Department of Education have met with the advocates yesterday, and we had a good conversation about the fix that was discussed here. There is proposed language in the works. I believe since it has a financial impact, we're waiting to put that on in an education finance environment. But I know we are hashing through language that is agreeable to everyone that limits the impact on Metro Deaf School.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Bonhoff and then Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to know what would be the fiscal implication. It's hard to understand that. And then when you say that limits the impact on Metro Deaf School, what do you mean by limits the impact? Because I think their testimony was so compelling that we around the table want there to be parental choice. And so could you expound on what you said?
I'm going to have to phone a friend here as I was not present for the discussions.
Mr. Chair and members, Beth Fraser with the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. And my understanding is that we have come up with language that will eliminate the problem for the Metro Deaf School. And my understanding is that depending upon how broadly or narrowly the language is written, it would have broader or narrower fiscal implications. And so I think the language at this point, the proposal will be written to just apply to the Metro Deaf School. Education policy is not my area of expertise, so I can't really elaborate more than that. But there will, of course, be a fiscal note on the proposal, and that could help and understand, help us all understand the fiscal impact.
Thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who from the department can answer this. Can you tell me what in your analysis changed and why we would not include a charter school to be a valid program and have to have a district referral for pre-K? I mean, parents, we don't have a mandated 4-year-old program or any preschool program. So why would we, is it just limited to the deaf school? Is it related to, is it limited to special ed? Is it, what are the parameters of this new finding that you found, and how did you come to it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, I am going to have to get some clarification from the department and the staff there that worked on this matter. I know that the discussions are ongoing. I believe this is out of since the discussions are ongoing, I'm going to have to get some clarification and get back to the committee on the answer.
We have Senator Pratt.
Follow up. When did this policy go into place and become effective?
Mr. Winnie, maybe you're taking notes on that, but the effective date on policy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, I don't have that information in front of me. I will have to respond back to the committee.
Okay. Now we have Senators Kent, Kiffmeyer, and Dames. I might just preempt that first by saying it's our desire that you have these continued conversations today with the hope that we could have an amendment ready to entertain when we act on this tomorrow. Given that you are having those discussions, I would ask that you reach an agreement today based on input that you've had. There was reference to a fiscal implication. We are in policy committee right now, but I think the intent is to address the concerns that have been raised. So that said, we can proceed to let them continue their meeting, or we can express some additional concerns, comments. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to expound a little on, because you sort of said exactly what I was. I want to make sure we don't lock anything down in the policy omnibus that would be at odds with what might come through the finance. So I appreciate your sense of urgency on this, and I agree. Thank you.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Either for the testifier or for staff, what is the rule or statute? I couldn't find it when I did a quick search that this is based on, that this issue or contention is stemming from. So what's the rule or statute?
I don't know if Ms. Butler has that. Mr. Winnie, you have that yet?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I know the rule that is referenced in my notes here are in reference to responsibility for ensuring provision and instruction of special education services. And the statute, would you like to reference the statute number? The statute that where the amended language would need to be going is 126C.05, 125A.75, subdivision 4, that's program and aid approval, and 124D.10, subdivision 8.
I'm sorry, point what?
I'm sorry. 124D.10, subdivision 8. And then the number for the rule is 3525.0800.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dames.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this comment or question, I guess, would be to the department, and that is just a few minutes ago they said that they had just started talking about this yesterday, and then just a few minutes after that, they said that they'd been in ongoing conversations, and I guess I'd like to know when they expect to have a conclusion. And if they don't have a conclusion by tomorrow, I certainly hope that we have an amendment come forward, that we can move forward. This is an unfortunate situation, and I don't think we can sit idly by and watch this go on. And there's really no excuse. This hasn't been ironed out. And I'd like to know from the department how long they've known about this issue and how long they've been in talks with this. If it's just yesterday or if you related to earlier, it's been an ongoing conversation, which it is, and why it's not done, taken care of.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe the issue was brought forth to us very recently, and we immediately scheduled an appointment with the advocates to work through the issue. Met with them yesterday. I will take back the sense of urgency brought up through testimony and from the committee back to the department immediately, and we will work with advocates to try to hash out some type of a workable compromise that the committee can view either today or tomorrow.
Okay. Members, we'll get an update soon. You have flagged the potential financial impact. Not knowing that range, it would likely then be something that would be addressed in our financial bill, which will roll out when we're in a different committee. But we could at least get an update tomorrow. We'd appreciate that, if not before. Okay. Thank you, and thank you, Ms. Sweet Milk and Ms. King, for your testimony.
Next, thank you.
We have Jim Bartholomew and Heidi Holster, followed by Brad Lundell. As testifiers are approaching, three other items that need to be processed with some amendments. We'll get to those last after we've followed with our testimony on the policy bill. Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and thank you for the opportunity to talk with you about Senate File 1495. While I'd like to highlight some of the provisions that would have a positive impact for students, such as the Chair's proposal in Article 1, Section 7, or Senator Kent's proposal in Article 2, Sections 26 and 27, or Senator Claussen's proposals to streamline licensure, these provisions are overshadowed by the inclusion of the governor's proposal to eliminate several state reading and math exams and the critical information that they would provide families, educators, and the public. These changes are in Article 2, Section 10. Under current law, Minnesotans have 6 years of information on student performance in reading and math, grades 3 through 8. Under the governor's proposal, which eliminates the math MCAs in grades 3 and 4 and the reading MCAs in grades 6 and 7, we're left with only 2 years of combined information, grades 5 and 8. As a parent, would you rather have 6 years of information or just two? For the state's own accountability system, the MMR, are we at a point where the state says math is no longer important in elementary schools or reading is not important in middle school? This huge shift in state assessment policies was not recommended by the governor's own testing reduction task force, nor was it recommended by the commissioner when she made her recommendations to the legislature on February 2nd. At the national level, there are diverse coalitions of people and organizations coming together to ask Congress to keep reading and math exams in grades 3 through 8 as a cornerstone of a reauthorized ESEA. The letter that's been handed out in your packets is a reflection of diverse groups, both locally and nationally, including the Education Trust, that want to protect the ability of Minnesotans to have key information in grades 3 through 8 so they can help students in schools. As is mentioned in the letter, the governor's proposal, again, Article 2, Section 10, will negatively impact the work being done by Generation Next to build connections between schools, community groups, and service providers to help students improve their reading and math skills. Why would we create barriers for this type of community-wide engagement? There's also nothing in Senate File 1495 that takes a holistic approach to concerns about too much testing. There's no effort to ask what value local districts get for the extra time and money they spend on third-party tests, nor anything about helping the department to develop and deliver more useful information. There's just a provision in Article 2 telling parents that it's okay to opt out. Just as there was growing consensus over state exams, the governor has offered a proposal to provide Minnesotans with less information and more confusion. We'd like to thank you for your time and commitment in putting together what would otherwise be a good policy bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Ms. Hessler.
Good morning. My name is Heidi Hilster. I am with Parents United for Public Schools, Chair Wieger Committee. One of the components of this bill that we fully support is the reduction of state tests. It's a consistent topic of concern with so many Minnesota families that we hear from and that we work with every day. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hessler. Next, Brad Lundell, followed by Roger Aronson. And Mr. Aronson, you're invited to join Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, very briefly today on behalf of the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education, want to thank you for putting in Senator Pratt's Senate File 740. We think that's a very, very important piece of legislation on the online reporting bill. I want to apologize to Senator Chamberlain that I didn't get to him sooner, but if you look at Section 62 in Article 2, we'd like to work with him on that dyslexia definition, because I think when you put specific learning disability in that first sentence, there's some confusion that references a handicapping condition or disability category in rule. And we want to make sure, in talking to staff, I don't think it's the intention of the dyslexia parents in that community that they don't want their children automatically identified as qualifying for special education. So we want to make sure that that's clear. And so, again, Senator Chamberlain, I apologize for not getting to you sooner with this, and we certainly want to work with you and other members to see if there's a middle ground we can find there. Thank you.
And Senator Chamberlain, for the record, we'll assume there will be that reaching out. Or
I'd love to. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Aronson.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Roger Aronson. I represent the Elementary and Secondary School Principals Association. First of all, we want to congratulate you on what we think is an excellent bill. We look forward to watching this bill progress and helping you support it as we put in the finance portions of it. A couple of things that I wanted to point out for the committee. Article 3, Sections 1 through 7 represents significant work on Senator Hoffman's discipline bill. That we appreciate Senator Hoffman's work on this and Senator Claussen's and the advocates for this as well. I think actually as you get a chance to look at that provision, you're going to see that it's very consistent with the discussion that we had with the committee surrounding Senate File 1001, I think is what the reference was there. And we look forward to attempting to implement those provisions. There are a couple of provisions of Senator Kent's bill in Article 2, 26 and 27 that relate to the assignment of students and improvement plan issues. We're working on language on that, continuing. We sent some language and we talked to Senator Kent. And I know that Senator Pratt is involved in that issue as well, and we're going to continue to work on that. I would say overall, we really appreciate the fact that this is a bill that isn't going to turn us on our heads next year. You're going to continue to allow us to implement our teacher evaluation systems. We can continue to evaluate and move forward with the bullying issues, with the EL issues, and we thank you for that as well, Mr. Chair. I think we're pleased to say that a lot of the things that don't appear here this year are going to allow us to effectively keep our feet on the ground and administer our schools next year. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Ms. Doslin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doslin. I represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Would like to just thank you for your work so far on all the various policy bills that have been coming through the committee, and want to thank to just highlight a few of the provisions in the bill that MASA is very excited about. One, we support the testing recommendations that are included in the bill. We've submitted a letter. I don't know if the committee members have seen it yet, but we did submit a letter stating our support. We thank you for your work on providing providing more school district flexibility in the determination of their school year, of their calendar, when they start school day. Although we would like a permanent repeal of the Labor Day start date, we appreciate the flexibility given this next school year, as well as the four-day school week and the flexible learning year. And then lastly, just appreciate and support your work on regarding teacher licensure. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kuhnquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Scott Kuhnquist with the Association of Metropolitan School District. And just want to echo my thanks to you, Mr. Chairman, and all the committee for the great work this session and really bringing forward a very solid policy bill. Just want to highlight a really few issues. We do appreciate you, Mr. Chairman, bringing forward the testing recommendations that the governor made. But we would like to continue to discuss those with you as you move forward over the next couple of weeks. Quite frankly, I'm getting mixed feedback from members, and they're really still digesting it and really trying to figure out exactly how this is going to impact teacher development evaluation, et cetera. So, but as you've heard, and you all know, you hear it from your own constituents, there is a strong desire to reduce testing. And so we really appreciate you bringing it forward and hope we can have a continued discussion over the next few weeks on that.
We will.
I'm sure you will. Thank you. Thank you also for the changes in the flexible learning year. We really think that is a local control decision that local school boards should be able to make, so we appreciate that. And we also appreciate the one-year Labor Day exemption, but we think what you have there actually would be a great compromise on an ongoing basis, just to set September 1st. And in that way, when we have those late Labor Days, it would allow school districts a little more flexibility. And then finally, echoing Ms. Dolzlin, we appreciate the licensure language in the bill. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. We look forward to working with you in the next several weeks.
Thank you. Sarah Pratt.
Thank you. Mr. Kuhnquist, to Mr. Bartholomew's comments, have your schools talked to you at all about why they're doing their own testing and what the gaps from MDE back to local districts are? And have you had those conversations with MDE?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pratt, yeah. I mean, and as you know, there was a task force that worked on this issue and studied it. And, you know, of course, the gaps really tend to be really being able to measure growth and getting results in a timely manner. And we know there's efforts underway to revise the MCAs to try to address some of those issues as well. And then, as I mentioned, another factor really is the teacher evaluation law and the agreements that some of the districts and their bargaining units have in place already, and some of them are using the MCAs, you know, for that purpose. So there's a lot of moving parts in this issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Chris, and we would invite anyone else that would like to testify to come to the table as there's room. Ms. Chris.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Cindy Chris with the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. I just want to thank you for all the work you've done in the licensure area. As I testified, I think that was just last week, on Senate File 559. I think Senator Claussen, I'm sure working with many of you and others, came up with some very reasonable compromises. Our interest is not in making it difficult for people, for example, from out of state to become licensed. Our interest is ensuring that all teachers in our classrooms have met the high standards that you and the Board of Teaching and others have set. And anything we can do to provide appropriate flexibility without undermining those standards, we're behind 100%. I just want to say that I'm the only very part-time lobbyist for MACD, and a lot of our folks are on spring break right now. So tomorrow morning I'm going to be over in the House because we're not quite as pleased with their omnibus policy bill as we are with yours. So there may not be anybody here tomorrow from MACD. But if any questions come up about licensure provisions, and we can be of assistance in responding to those, your staff know how to reach me, and we'd be very happy to follow up. So I wasn't even going to say anything today, but I wanted to be sure that my absence tomorrow, if any questions came up, was not somehow seen as a lack of interest in our part or commitment to what you're doing. Thanks.
Be an excused absence. You're on call.
I'll ask my mother for a note.
Yes. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Holly Craigthorpe. I'm a Minneapolis teacher, and I'm a Minneapolis and Minnesota parent and an advocate for Educators for Excellence. So I'm representing Educators for Excellence today and our 1,000 members. And I would love the assistance of a page, if possible, to pass out our handout. I want to thank you, of course, for all of your work, and in particular, I want to thank you for making me feel welcome here and for welcoming all of our teachers as we've asked to have meetings with you all. I know that a lot of work went into this omnibus bill, and in particular, I want to thank Senator Claussen for the inclusion of Senate File 559, which is one of our major priorities. I am worried, though, that we might miss real opportunity to work on increasing equity in our schools and in increasing teacher diversity in our schools. And so I want to advocate that we take some bold steps to make a couple of amendments for tomorrow. We are recommending to include Senate File 664, which would hold teacher prep programs accountable. Teacher candidates desperately need this kind of data. They should be accessible to them. They're spending thousands of dollars and years on their licensure, and they deserve to know which programs are effective, which ones aren't effective. And in addition, we love to be able to see which programs are serving teachers of color best, and so we would advocate that that data be disaggregated by race for sample sizes of 10 or more to make sure that we protect teacher privacy. I believe that we could work together to get something that you would all support and that we could maybe make some amendments to the original bill for possible inclusion tomorrow, and I'll be following up with you. Also, I think that we can really change the landscape of hard-to-staff schools by introducing Senate File 1497, which is authored by Mr. Chair and Senator Claussen and Senator Pratt. And that would allow QCOMP districts to more flexibly use the existing funds for hard-to-staff schools incentives. So I thank you again for your work, and I look forward to hopefully working with you within the next 24 hours. Thank you.
Yes, and thank you for your very active participation. Both your recommendations are in play in the Finance Committee. There is a financial implication, but their life would not be in the policy per se because of the financial implications, but they're alive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Stump.
Just a follow-up question. If I heard you correctly, that you wanted to use the alternative compensation for placement of hard to find teacher positions versus the alternative compensation for teacher development and evaluation?
So
is that what I heard?
Currently, the bonuses in statute, the bonuses are they're allocated to be used for teacher's personal goal or school goal, meeting those goals. But it restricts the use of the bonuses for any other use. And so our statute is just introducing one additional use for those bonus funds, not necessarily the funds that go toward the teacher evaluation or any the job-embedded professional development or any of the other components of QCOMP, but just flexibility specifically for the bonus component for districts who have schools that are hard to staff or positions that are hard to fill in order to incentivize them with either a hiring bonus or a bonus to retain those teachers that are strong or to compensate teachers with, like, an additional prep period, for example, so that we can keep strong teachers in those hard-to-staff schools.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to remind people who are here and members as well that only 41% of the students in the state, 41% of the students in the state have teachers that receive the QCOMP or the alternative compensation. So I think before we start spending QCOMP money to have hard to fill positions, I think we ought to have QCOMP funded or alternative compensation for all teachers throughout the state.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I appreciate those comments, and our members would definitely agree with the support of expanding QCOMP. And we also believe, like districts like mine, like MPS, could use those funds in a new, innovative way to attract effective and highly effective teachers to hard-to-staff schools.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Forsman.
Mr. Chair and Senators, good morning. My name is Frank Forsberg. I work at Greater Twin Cities United Way as a Senior Vice President, and I'm also here today as the chairperson for the Mini Minds Coalition. It's a statewide coalition with more than 100 members, and as you may know, we've been advocating for the past 2 years for early learning scholarships for all low-income children. About 20,000 children who could be served, we think, rather quickly with early learning scholarships. I just have one point for today, and that is on the scholarship cap. And it's noted here in the bill on page 93, and it starts on line 9 if you'd want to take a look. As you may know, when the Minnesota scholarship program rolled out 2 years ago, it started with an initial scholarship cap of $5,000 per scholarship. That was in an effort to get that program up and rolling. Last year, legislation was passed to lift the cap and implementation deferred to 2016. The piece that I want to bring to your attention is the line here that says, for fiscal year 2016 and later, the commissioner shall establish a target for the average scholarship amount based on the results of a rate survey. And it just begs me to ask the question about how might that average scholarship amount be interpreted. So are we thinking that we might move from a hard cap of $5,000 to something incrementally higher that might be an average? That could be one interpretation of that line. The Mini Minds Coalition, I think, would like to see stronger language that would suggest or indicate that scholarships could be used to meet the full needs of our most vulnerable children. And in many cases, that would mean access to a full-day, year-round program. And I just want to make sure that that's a very strong part of the use of scholarships and very strongly considered here, because we'd hate to limit access for the most vulnerable children to the programs that they probably most need. I also want to remind the committee that the state of Minnesota has been the beneficiary of the Race to the Top federal funding, and that four of our communities are recognized as transformation zones. The White Earth Indian Reservation and the Itasca County in Greater Minnesota, as well as North Minneapolis through Northside Achievement Zone and the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. Each of those communities has 3 years of on-the-ground experience using very flexible federally funded scholarships that did not have a cap limit and allowed for those communities to make the best use of full-day, year-round programming for their most vulnerable children. And so I want to make sure we use the information that we have available, the results that have been generated by those three communities in the defining of the scholarship amounts to make sure that those most vulnerable children are served well. And then one last link, the bill goes to, I think, really nice lengths to identify teen parents, children of homeless families, foster care families. I think we know that those children are going to benefit most from a full-day, year-round experience. So just another reason to make sure we're very clear on that language. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Forsberg. And I believe we incorporated each of your suggestions in your previous testimony on the cap. May I assume you're in discussions with the commissioner?
Yes, we certainly are, and of course want to bring those discussions here to you as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning, members and Mr. Chairman. Grace Kelleher with the Minnesota School Boards Association. I will be really quick in basically what we like. We like the Labor Day flexibility for the 1 year. We've had a lot of superintendents call us with that concern and wanting some flexibility around that date since it's such a late start. We really appreciate the flexibility for the four-day week. You know, there are programs that are very successful there, and it's very meaningful to have that in there. We're really sort of also excited about what you did to the science credits for kids to take. You gave them some flexibility around agriculture in a state where 1 in 5 people are employed in agriculture. It makes sense. Our kids have more ability to look at that. Also, the computer science being used as a math credit. What a great idea. It really recognizes that logical thinking you get from math in a different way, and I really want to encourage those efforts. It just reaches out and grabs more kids coming forward. We also like from Senator Claussen's bill the temporary teacher licensure from 2 to 4 years. That's a big change, and we really appreciate those words. We got a couple concerns we're going to work with members on and some concerns about effective dates, but we'll work with those before tomorrow's meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And if I may ask, on testing, any general thoughts?
Well, Mr. Chairman, certainly we like the idea of less testing. Where we might have a little concern, and that's why we want to reach out to some members and get their response, is over time that longitudinal list. I mean, the testing statute itself for the last 17 years hasn't been changed in only 3 years. So every year we seem to keep tweaking the animal, and we'd like to see some ongoing. We're also got concerns about what the federal government is going to do. So we'll get farther on that by tomorrow, Mr. Chairman. But we certainly, the reduction looks nice, but we just want to make sure we can continue to have information about how our kids are doing.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, Josh Downham with the Minneapolis Public Schools. I want to echo the previous testifiers. This is a very strong bill. In particular, appreciate Senator Claussen's work around licensure portfolio and out-of-state licensure expansion so we can increase the pool of potential licensed teachers. As you know, we hired 500 teachers this last year. We really do need additional tools in our arsenal. We also appreciate the inclusion of the seals of biliteracy changes that will allow students in Minnesota to access college credit at Minscu campuses for their demonstration of fluency in multiple languages in addition to English. And, Senator, we do actually have concerns about the scaling back of the MCAs at 3 and 4 for math and 6 and 7 for English. We do use those assessments for our teacher development and evaluation. We look forward to working with the department and the committee on ways to kind of smooth that out.
And for the record, you could continue to offer tests that we may eliminate or not require.
Certainly, that's correct.
Thank you. Anyone else like to address the draft policy bill?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis, and I'm representing Hospitality Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, I think the words were spoiler alert. I think it was Monday night when we talked about it, but just to give you a different face on this, because it's usually Mr. Bagnoli and Mr. Carlson, and I've taken an oath to work with them and come up and just object, Mr. Chairman, obviously to Article 2, Section 65 on the school start date. And I just wanted to get that on the record, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. Further testimony before we proceed to other bills. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Rachel Berger, and I represent Decoding Dyslexia, a group of parents locally that are working on. We've been working on advocacy for the past 2 years for our dyslexic children's needs in the state of Minnesota, and I want to thank you for you and the committee members for the support this session with the hearings and collaboration on this issue. I just wanted to comment on the comment that was made earlier regarding the definition. And
we're referencing Mr. Lundell's testimony?
Yes, I'm okay. Sorry. I wasn't certain who
that
was.
Just for others that, okay.
The use and the terminology in the definition is something that that is consistent with the DSM, with the National Institute of Health, and with what the International Dyslexia Association uses when qualifying what dyslexia is. And in fact, dyslexia is a specific learning disability. So I think not having that term in there would make it awfully confusing to people on whether it is a disability or it is not. It is a specific learning disability. So I just wanted to clarify that. We're being consistent. There are other states who have passed dyslexia definition in legislation, and we're using the terminology that they are using. This isn't something that we have crafted on our own. We're trying to be consistent with the bodies that be that determine what dyslexia is.
Thank you. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to be in support here of Decoding Dyslexia. I'm a Minnesota licensed teacher, and just how worthwhile it would be to have.
And please, for the record, restate your name.
Oh, my name is Kira Campbell. Sorry.
Thank you.
And how worthwhile it would be for teachers to be able to know what specifically dyslexia is and to know that they can use this term with students in schools, and a much better term than having nothing to go with it. Otherwise, students right now are just being labeled as lazy or just not wanting to do anything. So thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Any further testimony before we proceed on? Mr. Heller, welcome.
Thank you, Senate Education Committee, Mr. Wigger, Chair, members, for this opportunity to speak on, I think it's 360 is the bill?
Excuse me?
The bill is 360, is that correct?
It's Senate File 1495.
1495?
Yes, we have a delete all amendment, which was posted, and we have hard copies here, and then we'll be...
I do have a
suggestion tomorrow.
Thank you, Chair.
So if it pertains to the policy bill.
It is, and it's about accessibility. Currently, I've been working on a complaint for about 3 years about how it struck through underline and plain language on these bills that I read out loud for the blind and visually impaired. I've yet to clarify from anybody at the legislature or whoever is a power user of JAWS that's really functional. I think that's important for engagement for those individuals that don't have the access, perhaps like I may have. I hope that somebody can provide a reference that can be clarified. I think that's important as we continue to move on accessibility law to capital with legislature. Regarding this one testifier, I happen to heard the word dyslexia. I unofficially represent the twice exceptional and print disabled. And hopefully we're going to hear a bill about this soon. I've had a lot of experience with those that are labeled language-based disability from the neuroscience group, or something like I heard earlier, SLD, specific learning disability. And if they are taking the word out, dyslexia, even though it's a medical terminology, I think it's very relevant to one specific thing. I do believe these individuals have a high ability and potential of learning. However, if you take the word dyslexia out, I think it kind of takes away from what the National Institute of Science of Child Development said in 1997 from Ms. Shaywitz when they decided that dyslexia was a real thing for child development. And hopefully it's not going to be removed, but that the committee, when they come together with the legislature, I mean the House, that they... consider that word that it needs to be in statute, because I do know specifically for myself, I understand it orally, but when it comes to writing, it's pretty hard for my ability regarding the print area being able to spell. And I know for a fact my experience with school personnel is we can't hold people accountable for something they don't know how to do for word analysis when it comes to early intervention for the K through 3 learners. So again, the relevance of this is to bring to the fact that if these are the part of the print disability people found in the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008 next to the blind, and it's all about meeting the effectiveness of the printed word, that it would be appropriate again to include this in this bill if it's missing. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
And thank you for your participation, Mr. Heller. And there are, you know, the advocates that had just previously testified, but perhaps you can have a conversation following the meeting regarding mutual concerns. Is there anyone else that'd like to testify on Senate File 1495, the delete all? This will be the last time I call out on that. Is there anyone additionally? Okay. Members, we will adopt the delete all amendment tomorrow when we meet, and then we will look at potential amendments, confer with various persons to the extent you think that's helpful in providing as much information as we can for the Department of Education, for many of their provisions. Please get to them if there's a need for clarification. There's a significant amount of collaboration, of consensus building that has gone into this draft, and I compliment each of you for your good faith efforts in doing that, and that's why we have reached a great deal of support. Can it improve? We can always improve, and to the extent we've had some additional comments, suggestions, we'll make that our goal. So, members, we will look at the omnibus policy bill tomorrow, and hopefully we'll be able to complete it by 11 o'clock a.m. And if we aren't on Thursday, then we'll meet Friday morning to continue our discussion. Next, we're going to go to three bills that are here for processing, and two of them I believe have reached consensus, and I'm going to ask Senator Johnson to chair the meeting.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senate File 811 is the omnibus finance bill. It does not have the policy implications that we're adopting, and I'm just to facilitate that it go to the Finance Committee, I would move that Senate File 811 without recommendation be re-referred to Finance.
Members, you've heard the motion. Any questions? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
Motion carries. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we have Senate Files 334 and 343. First, Senate File 334, Senator Johnson addressing vision screening. And we'll ask if you could go to the table with any testifiers. As we've encouraged, when there's concerns expressed by groups on the impact of a bill, we ask that the authors reach out. And there was a delete all amendment, or at least some amendment has been posted, and we'll ask Senator Johnson to update us on that, and I believe we have an A3 amendment as well. So, Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, we do have the A3 amendment is really the only amendment we're going to have today. And I'd like to tell you about that, and I offer Amendment A3 to the bill, Senate File 334.
This is an author's amendment, Senator Johnson, on the, and then you'll speak to the amendment, and perhaps just to refresh everyone, the overall bill. But on the author's amendment, the A3, all in favor, indicate aye.
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 Opposed? Adopted. We have Senate File 334 as amended, and it's ultimately the author's intent that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to Finance. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, we've had the discussion on this bill, Senate File 334, that calls for in its original state, it called for requiring a comprehensive eye exam for any child before they enter kindergarten. Since that time, we've had a lot of discussion with many different groups and have come up with the amendment that you see in front of you. The amendment, what it does is Basically, first of all, let me explain that. The Department of Health and the Department of Education, we've had discussions with them. They are neutral on the bill. We've met with the school nurses and the early childhood people, and they are in agreement with the bill after the amendment has been added. So with that, I'll tell you what we did. If you look at the bill, you'll see that we reinstated the stricken language, and then on line 8, line 9, we deleted the new language. So basically, we went back to the original statute. And so then we added on line 10, after the word weight, which is just one of the elements of the screening program, and added that the screeners we put in the language the date of the child's most recent comprehensive vision examination. So when the children come in for their screening at the school before they are coming into kindergarten or maybe earlier, that they will also be asking the parents if they have had a comprehensive eye exam and when the date that was. And that is the end of it. We're hoping that the schools then will, if there is a vision problem in their screening, when they come up with their screening and they find a vision problem, that they will then say that, find out if they have insurance and let them know that that they likely have coverage for a comprehensive eye exam and eyeglasses or whatever else is required. Then further on in the amendment, you'll see we changed the title. So we deleted everything on page 1, line 2. We deleted after the semicolon and inserted modifying the components of the early childhood developmental screening program. And so, therefore, it's taking out requiring a comprehensive vision examination before kindergarten enrollment. So we have a new title to the bill. It will be saying modifying the components of the early childhood developmental screening program. As I've mentioned earlier, the groups that we've talked with have been supportive and are okay with the bill. I appreciate your support.
Senators Peterson and Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson, looking at the situation where the student doesn't have coverage, health coverage in particular, that I'm assuming the school district must refer the child to an appropriate health care provider. That would mean that they would bear the cost of doing that as well. Is that correct?
Or they would not. According to my understanding with the council telling us, this would not require the school districts to provide that service. They would be required to refer the child to an eye doctor, but they would not be covered. They would not have to cover the cost.
Senator Pearson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, what's the remedy in that situation then? I guess walk me through how that works when a family is not able to do that.
Ms. Doslin.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Valerie Doslin, I represent the Minnesota Community Ed Association. My understanding in talking with the folks that do all the early childhood screening through community ed, they currently already, they do refer a child to an ophthalmologist or an optometrist, and they also will provide information on, if they don't have a health insurance, they'll also provide them resources where they can find access to health insurance. So currently when a child is screened, if in the screening it appears that there are vision problems, they do refer the child, say, to the parents, you should have them see an optometrist or an ophthalmologist. And they try to do follow-up to make sure that that has actually occurred.
Sarah Pearson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, Ms. Doslin, forgive me for my ignorance. What do we
what are we doing that's different then? If it's already taking place and we're already making the referral and we're already screening vision, what are we adding here that didn't exist before?
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, what I see is that this will bring to the forefront the needs of children, and that they will then become more accustomed to when they hear, the parents hear, that they have insurance that would cover the eye exam. Approximately, I would hope 75% of the people would have the insurance that would cover an eye exam and glasses, and that they would be encouraged to get that exam and continue on every year having an eye exam as they become more aware of the importance of it. This is a national problem. It's not a Minnesota issue. That's why the Affordable Care Act included as a requirement that policies have a vision screening or vision exam and reimbursement for the eyeglasses or therapy or whatever it might be. So that's what I see is happening. It's a small start. I would rather have something more comprehensive, I would say, but it is a good start, I'd say.
On that point, Mr. Harrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to help Senator Johnson answer that question. I'm representing Chef Harris on behalf of the Minnesota Optometrics Association, who's brought this language forward. Thank you, Senator Johnson. Senator Peterson, to answer your question, what we're trying to do, you might remember in the testimony that was offered a couple weeks ago on this bill, we handed out an example of a sheet from the Hermantown Community Schools District, which had the screening form, if you will, of all the different items that the parent needs to take care of in order for their child to be enrolled at the school. And the first line on that form was a comprehensive eye exam. And so basically that's what we're looking for with this language, is that you're going to get that line there. It's going to incentivize the parent or parents to get that child a comprehensive eye exam so that they can enroll their child into the school. We're just trying to simplify the language. There was some confusion, I think, the way it was written. There was some confusion between the education department, the health department, with different organizations that you've heard about screening versus referral and how that would be done. And so we're trying to simplify the language. It's still a work in progress, but I think it's definitely a step in the right direction.
Sarah Bonoff.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I may have missed something because I was scrambling through my papers as you were doing your beginning talk, and so I apologize if I'm asking questions that you addressed. But it looks to me with this amendment that you are requiring every child to have a vision examination performed by an optometrist or ophthalmologist versus those who have just been screened by their pediatrician and found to have a potential issue. Does this, in fact, require every child to have a specialist versus the pediatric screening?
Chair Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, the bill as amended would ask for the school to have the question asked and answered if they have had a comprehensive eye exam, which means an eye exam by an optometrist or an ophthalmologist, and what date that was. And after that is up to the people who are responsible for the children to take care of it.
Mr. Chair, if I may help answer that as well. Now we're starting to get into more of the technical health and human service issues, Senator Bonoff. Yes, there's the pediatrician screening opportunities, but unfortunately the pediatrician doesn't have the expertise that an optometrist or an ophthalmologist will have when it comes to a comprehensive eye exam, which is different from a screening. The screening that is done either in the school by a volunteer parent or by a school nurse or in a pediatrician's office is a basic distance vision type of examination, as opposed to going into an ophthalmologist's office or an optometrist where they're going to be looking at a more comprehensive health of the eye than what a pediatrician would do. So there may be some overlap, but the examination that's done by the ophthalmologist or optometrist is much more comprehensive.
Sarah Bonoff.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, so I don't yet support this because the very, very few that might that we might miss by not having a more comprehensive approach, I think we're adding a tremendous amount of cost to the overall healthcare delivery system. That's what I heard from the ophthalmologists and optometrists in my area. They said this is addressing an issue with a much broader approach than what the problem actually is. I understand about parent volunteers, but I think pediatricians who screen really do have strong expertise in ferreting out where kids need to see specialists. And so I feel as though in the Senate E-12 committee is not the proper place to add a recommendation for a specialist. I think that would be best served in the HHS committee. I don't think that we have the expertise around this table to broaden the definition of screening to include specialists because that is in our purview, in my opinion.
Sarah Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I believe this is going to the Health and Human Services Committee. Is that correct or not? Has it been?
I'll have to ask staff if there's been a request for a referral.
Shouldn't do it.
Pardon me? I believe
Mr. Chair, I'd prefer that it wouldn't.
Okay. We'll need to get I'll need to get a clarification in writing on that. I as to if there's been a formal recommendation.
Mr. Chair, if I might address Senator Bonoff's comments about, this is maybe overreach or... I'm telling you that from my experience, and, I don't like to talk about anecdotal things, but it seems every time that I sit down and talk with some people in my office, and we all have so many people visiting, oftentimes after we have our discussions, I bring up the vision bill and ask what they think of it. And there have been so many people that have come forward to say that they didn't hear about or know about their vision issues. And it's known that 25% of the kids have vision issues that affect their learning. We heard today how 0 to 5 is so important. To go every year for an eye exam with your child from the time that they're born, I think after they're 1 year old, I would say they should be taken every year for an eye exam. But we can't really require that from people. But if we can make some example and some encouragement come out of our schools, and the reason is, as I have said from the very beginning, this is, I believe, one of the most lucrative ways to improve the achievement gap and to keep people out of trouble and out of special ed programs. So I think it's well worth its while for an education committee to look into this.
And members, this would go to finance in the referral, and presumably the Health Human Service Division would look at it. I believe the fiscal note was about $2.5 million or so, but in terms of the policy, is a good idea to be ready for K with a vision correction plan in place or having any visual issues addressed. That's our jurisdiction, I believe. And then finance would look at, which division might finance it and whether we would adopt that. But Senator Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Johnson, what I guess I was getting at earlier with my questions, and it seemed at least at first like the answer was essentially we're doing this already. Then I heard the exchange with Senator Bonoff, which suggested that we're really not and we're adding a layer. And if there is a fiscal note, particularly that's $2.5 million, would lead me to believe that that's the cost on the public programs for those that don't have coverage, which means the cost for other families that do have coverage are going to be borne by those families to the tune of, I would imagine, probably 7, 8, 9, 10 million, depending on whatever the proportion of private coverage is in the the marketplace. So it does seem we're adding significant costs in ways that may not always be necessary. I do agree with the general goal that you're putting forward, which is, you know, you can on the front end reduce special ed costs potentially and other things by screening these people to make sure that their education issues aren't, you know, are maybe more of a physical, you know, barrier than a mental barrier. And I think that's a good idea. I think the Senator Bonoff's concerns are well-founded. I would hope this would go to HHS committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
One person who would like to speak in favor of the bill, if you would.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Mr. Chair and senators, I'm one of the people that was in Senator. Oh, I'm sorry, Peg Larson, L-A-R-S-E-N, and I should know to do that. I apologize. I'm one of the people that was in Senator Johnson's office, and we were talking about the vision bill. And I let her know that all of my childhood, I went to a Catholic school, and the nuns just kept moving me back to the back of the room for lack of trying. And I knew that I was not trying. So went to public junior high, once again, same thing. Went to take my driver's test and found out that my vision was really very poor. All those years that I could have been, excuse me, learning quite a bit of things in your formative years, I just missed all of that and sat in the back of the room and got shyer and shyer. And believe it or not, to this day I'm still very shy, but I know people laugh at that, but it's true.
You became a state representative.
I know. And you know, that was outside my box. So I really think that this is an important issue to look at. I understand the insurance part of it, but if this bill helps even just one or two children to not go through what I went through and have low self-esteem and miss I love to read, and not being able to read the things that I wanted to read. I did finally, after I got my glasses, picked up my grades, went to college, graduated from the University of Slippery Rock, if anybody has ever heard of Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania, and went on to, as you said, Mr. Chair, become a state representative and a mayor and a city council person. So I'm very thankful that my eyesight was caught at a point that it was, but I truly wish a bill like Senator Johnson's had been in place so that it could have been caught much earlier. And I thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair, if I can help explain a point that Senator Peterson was making about the extra layer. It's really not an extra layer. This is already a mandated service. It's part of the essential health benefits that was part of the Affordable Care Act. So the service has already been mandated that all children under the age of 19 are allowed and covered to get a comprehensive eye exam, different from screening, much more comprehensive in detail. So I don't necessarily want to say it's an extra layer. It's already there. The cost is something that hopefully we can address in the Finance Committee or
Thank
Budget
you.
Division.
Is there anyone else that would like to address Senate File 334 as amended? Anyone further? Senator Johnson, would you like to make a motion?
I'd like to move that Senate File 334 as amended be laid over and considered in the
I believe, members, that would be recommended to pass and re-referred to Finance.
Okay.
On that motion, further discussion? Not all in favor, indicate aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carries.
Division.
Division's been called. All in favor, please raise your hand. And someone's counting, I believe. You have the yes votes. And all opposed, please raise your hand.
Ooh, it's tied. Nine.
I can't hear. It failed. Okay. It failed. On the web phone. Okay. On a vote of 7-4 and 10 against, the motion does not prevail.
Sorry about that.
Senator Johnson. Our next bill is Senate File 343, Senator Kent. And again, there's a delete all amendment, some amendments, and we'll ask you to bring any testifiers to the table and open it up for discussion. We have had a previous hearing on this, and so maybe just a brief background, then we'll open it up for any amendment. Senator Johnson. Excuse me, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, as Senator Wieger reminds us, we did hear this bill. It was back in January. That feels like quite a while ago. So it was a very, very brief refresher. The idea behind Senate File 343 is to update the physical education efforts in the state of Minnesota and our schools. It is very much supported by research that active students perform better in schools, they learn better, and obviously that leads to both short-term and long-term health benefits. As we discussed at the time of the original bill hearing, there were some concerns that we were working on, and I am really grateful for a number of stakeholders continuing to work on this, including members of the committee. Senator Pratt has made some very constructive contributions to the amendment, and we've worked with a variety of the educational advocates, as well as the health and wellness advocates, to come up with what we think is a good consensus moving forward. So we have the A3 amendment, which, just to sort of briefly summarize the key points, a lot of it is clarifying in technical language. More substantively, we are pushing back the implementation of the assessments for 1 year. We are removing the graduation requirement for PE. We're removing Section 5, Subdivision 1, which was a rather detailed element of school requirements. This was part of Senator Pratt's helpful contribution. We've rolled it into an existing report. Within the excused absence from PE, we're adding in the doctor's excuse. And regarding recess, using recess as punishment or disciplinary action, we've eased that from being a must not do that to a strongly encouraged not to do that. And so with those changes, we think we have reached really solid consensus, and this becomes a bill that hopefully everybody can support as being really good for kids and really good for learning. And with that, are there any questions?
Senator Kent, would you like to move the A3 amendment? We have that in front of us, I believe.
So, yes, I would move the A3 amendment as described.
On the A3 amendment discussion, not all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one thought I had that it's happening in some school districts around the country where they have, the school districts have placed exercise equipment in rooms such as a library or a study hall, or, you know, and you have like walking machines, you have standing desks, you have, you know, riding machines. And I don't recall exactly where I read the information, but some of the research on it is that students that do that, and they comprehend more because they're activating certain portions of their brain that are used for memorizing or learning or stimulating their learning pattern. And I just mentioned this, that it would be good. I don't have a bill or anything, but it would be good for school districts to try that, I think. And that way they can study and exercise at the same time. And we complain about the shortness of recesses and stuff like that. Children have an enormous amount of energy, and it's hard for children to sit very long. This would be an opportunity for them to work some of that energy off, plus learn in a better fashion.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Stumpf, because you are reflecting the same sort of research. It absolutely shows that the more that we get those little bodies moving throughout the day, the more effective they are, both in paying attention and focusing, and then also during the times when they have some downtime and away from that active listening and processing, their brains are able to shift into a different mode, and they better absorb and retain the information. So the kinds of moves that you're talking about that we've seen in a number of school districts, both around the state and around the country, are very productive. They are not a part of this bill, as you indicated. But, again, the hope is that as a collective group of people supporting education both here and throughout our state, that we appreciate how important these aspects of our kids' lives are to learning. It, sometimes people think it's either or, and what we're trying to say, it's both and. Thank you.
Would anyone else like to address Senate File 343 as amended? Mr. Heller.
Thank you, Chair Wigger, and those on the Education Committee and the Senate. I'm speaking on Senate File 343. I'd like to just go to the document, if we could, on lines 422 and 426. I'm here unofficially representing the Twice Exceptional Print Disabled. Now, the question is, as we continue to move ahead with assessments, I believe we find a...
Mr. Heller, those items were deleted in the Senator Kent's amendment.
The whole section has been deleted?
With the amendment.
Oh, with the amendment?
Mm-hmm.
How about down below, then, on the other line?
Which lines?
Oh. Let's go to the back page. Here's another word. On page, I believe it's on page... It talks about assessments here. Assess their fitness levels, all right?
Yes, that's still on there.
Okay. And then on I believe 5.8 talks about modifications and adaptations as well. The piece of this is about universal design. We have one place in the country called the National Center for Education Outcomes that look at tools of principle of universal design for engagement for those that can best show their ability and potential based on valid and reliable information. As we continue to move ahead on this engagement piece, which is called the Y network, the FET network, which is the working memory, I believe somebody had testified earlier about the functionality of working memories. That's our working memory. That's important that we consider principle of universal design for fitness. Now, obviously, it's in assessments. So how are we going to meet principle of universal design in the actual physical assessment? Is that correct? There's going to be a physical assessment here based on their performance?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Sir, Ken.
So how does that fit into... their assessment regarding what adaptations and modifications, which is basically a 504 plan or a combination list for a student that has an individual education plan. Will that be written into their individual plan? Is that a requirement here, or is that just an option to consider?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Karen.
And Mr. Heller, the bill is saying that within this is about recess. The section that you're referring to is saying that for students who do have a disability, and that would involve an IEP or a 504, that there would be adaptations made in that case. This is separate from the assessments part.
So, again, this is just meeting the functionality within the IEP for those individual students?
Yes.
All right, well, thank you for I just want to understand. I appreciate your time explaining that for me. Thank you much.
You're welcome, Mr. Heller. Thank you. Senator Pratt and Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kent, when we talked about this bill last time, we talked specifically about line 5.9, the student could not be excluded from recess due to punishment or disciplinary action. And I know there was some discussion about the allowance of alternative physical activity, and I'm not seeing that here or that allowance here. And can you discuss that?
Mr. Chair, okay. Senator Pratt, the amendment, and it is line, I'm trying to alternative?
1.15.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoff. The new provision there would read, schools are strongly encouraged not to exclude students in kindergarten through grade 5, I'm trying to read my handwriting there, from recess due to punishment or disciplinary action. So it addresses it by just making it a strong encouragement.
Got it.
Without being prescriptive on the details.
Thank you. Sorry I missed that.
Yeah. Senator Bonham.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kent, I too wanted to talk about that particular fix. I'm not satisfied with that fix. And so what I'm wondering, I understand why you did it. I'm wondering if perhaps, well, first of all, I guess, would this then go in the policy bill, in which case would we have a chance to work with you between now and tomorrow? Because I'm thinking one idea is, of course, an alternative. Another idea would be a reporting requirement so that any student that was not allowed to go to recess due to a disciplinary action would we would have to have that reported either to the principal, to the superintendent, or some way at least having visibility so that there has to be some kind of a second look at that.
Mr. Chair. Excuse me, Senator Kent, it's our intent that this would go to finance.
Okay.
There is some related policy, but it would be cleaner if to put it in finance to the extent there's some collection of information from the department. So, and I think I know the author will work with stakeholders, as she has been very diligently, to perfect this.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, I like that idea, so let's keep talking.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate File 343 as amended? If not, Senator Kent, a motion to pass and be referred to finance?
I so move. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on Senate File 343 as amended? If not, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. Thank you very much, Senator Kent, and to the various stakeholders and working on this. May those efforts continue. Members, we will meet tomorrow at 8 a.m., room 107, and at that time we'll look at the omnibus policy bill. As I had encouraged before, if there's amendments, please reach out to various persons that may have an interest, including us on the committee, as it's worked pretty well so far, and obviously working with the Department of Education as well, to the extent there may be some need for follow-up on some of their initiatives. Any questions regarding tomorrow? Very good. If not, the committee stands adjourned.